Welcome to the Queen of the Sciences podcast, conversations between a theologian and her dad. I'm your host, Sarah Henlicky Wilson.
And I am Paul R. Henlicky.
Today on the show, we are talking about fear and phobias and how not to fear and how to think about fear and how not to think about fear. And as you can already tell from that introduction, this is going to be a little more freeform, loosey-goosey. It's a topic Dad and I both wanted to address, but it is less obviously self-organizing as, say, you know, Bonhoeffer's Christology or something like that. So, and this will be a little bit more on the side of trying to interpret our own times and put some positive constructions on how to live courageously in a fear-based climate. And we by no means live in the most fear-based climate in the world, that's for sure. So, Dad, you were the one who really pushed that we have this topic. So just tell us briefly before we dig into it, why in particular you wanted to address fear and phobias.
Well, there's a number of reasons why, but we'll get down into the weeds on this shortly, but I've just noticed this cacophony of terminology that has evolved in my adult life. Homophobia, Islamophobia, Christophobia, you can go on and on with all the phobias that have multiplied in the social discourse. And I'm just very curious about how that evolution in language has occurred and what it might be indicating. So we'll get into that shortly.
Okay. Well, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, so we are told. And so there is, I think the first thing to say right off is that fear is not in and of itself a bad thing. And that is, of course, we also hear that as Lutherans, especially in Luther's Catechism, defining the first commandment as to fear, love, and trust in God above all things. Fear comes first of those things. Dad, you probably also have spent a lot of time trying to explain to people what that doesn't mean. It doesn't mean cowering in a slavish manner in front of an angry God who's about to drop you into hell. The way actually, Dad, I came to understand that is during my first call when I realized that I feared the sound of the phone ringing with a call from a member of my church council more than I feared God. And I thought to myself, this is disordered. One cannot be a faithful pastor if one fears council members' phone calls more than the Lord Almighty. So I think that is the kind of the deep root of wisdom here is that the fear of the Lord, as opposed to the fear of anything else, is the most important thing. But then we also have this other scriptural attestation that there are times to fear not. In fact, most angels preface whatever message they're bringing by saying, "Fear not." I noticed when I was looking through the uses of a fear and fear language in the Gospel of Mark for my Transfiguration project, the disciples actually have to learn how to be afraid of Jesus. It's when he stills the storm that suddenly they're like, "Oh, crap, who is this guy that wind and sea obey him?" But it's only after they learn to fear him that Jesus can start saying to them, "Do not fear." So it's very, and actually, just a little side note, at the Transfiguration, they are most afraid. Most of the time when fear is talked about in the Gospel of Mark, it's the normal verb in the past tense for they were afraid. But in the Transfiguration, they are ek-phoboi. Ek is the out of. So it's sort of like they're afraid out of their wits. And very interestingly, the Transfiguration is the high point, literally and figuratively, of disciples' fear, which I think is quite interesting. So there's a kind of, let's say, a dialectic between healthy fear and healthy relinquishing of fear in the scriptural witness itself. So, yeah, I think that's a good place to kind of launch this exploration of fear and its uses and abuses in our culture now.
Well, sure, because fear is just a instinctual reaction to perceived danger, and danger is real. There are real dangers out there in the world, and fear is an instinctually necessary, and if the danger that you perceive is in fact real, it's an appropriate emotional response, right? So fear is a healthy. If a little child doesn't learn to fear putting its fingers into the pretty blue flame, it will end up with roasted fingers, right?
Right.
I mean, it's appropriate to develop a healthy fear for what is objectively dangerous.
Yeah, and I would just add from an evolutionary perspective, fear is the least costly way of protecting a creature, an animal in the wilds, which is if you run away, you don't fight, you don't get bloodied, you don't get killed. So fear is the easiest, least costly, least destructive, least violent action. So again, there is a good and healthy place for fear. What we'll be talking about is how that system gets hacked. As we've talked about before, about hacking the law, you can also hack the law of instinctive fear response.
Right. So, you know, and just I think this will be a little bit more theological than maybe you indicated at the outset, Sarah, because I'm old enough, and maybe you are too, to remember John Paul II, the Polish Pope, in the 1980s, who finally got permission to return to his native soil in Poland and have an outdoor mass, which was attended by hundreds of thousands of Polish people. And his message, which he had actually begun at his inauguration as the Pope, his message to the people still living under the thumb of Brezhnev's real existing socialism, the Marxist-Leninist regime in Poland, his message was a resounding, fear not. And what was so remarkable about John Paul II in preaching that is that he was the most Christocentric pope that I can remember in my lifetime. When he said, fear not, he immediately cited John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That's the reason why Christian people of faith are not able actually, in so far as they believe, to be victims of fear. They are resourced in the Father's love for us, revealed in his Son, Jesus Christ. And he even went on to say something like this: don't be afraid to be holy, but be holy as you have been washed in Christ in baptism, and you have been endowed with the Holy Spirit, which gives you courage to face the dangers of life, knowing that whatever the world throws at you, you are held in the arms of God's eternal love. So in my lifetime, John Paul II's witness in this way was remarkable. And it brought down the entrenched Marxist-Leninist regime in Poland.
What a wonderful example of a Christian response to fear, and I which is courage, right? Well, this is a universal human virtue and a possibility to be courageous in the face of fear. And I think, you know, something as dire as a repressive communist regime is a good indication that courage, faithful courage or virtuous courage, is actually in response to something that is genuinely dangerous and something that it is legitimate to be afraid of. So there's a correlation that has to be acknowledged. Courage is not refusing to acknowledge danger or not feeling any fear at all. It's actually feeling fear and then being able to make some kind of decision, or having been so formed that you instinctively refuse to let the fearful thing dominate your soul, because your soul is already in submission to something else. And John Paul's wonderful example, in submission to the God who gave his only son out of love for us.
Right. And, you know, there you have the Deutero-Pauline admonition to put on the whole armor of God, right? And we remember the podcast last year on Paul Tillich. Now, you didn't like the courage to be, but I do think that his analysis shows that what faith, genuine faith, is existentially interpreted is courage. Courage to face the dangers without being overwhelmed by them, and to proceed in a way that is faithful in the face of danger. So I think that's a very helpful thing for people to realize. What faith really cashes out as in real life is courage.
Yeah, C.S. Lewis has a nice point that courage is every virtue at the sticking point. You know, it's easy to be all sorts of good things until there's actually some real or perceived danger to yourself. And then courage is finally the expression of every virtue. And I think that's a very helpful way of thinking about it. And it really connects to what you've often talked about, Dad, in the theology of the martyrs. You know, what is faith finally? Faith is so much courage that you will actually put your own physical body on the line. Which is not to say that psychological courage can't be just as tremendous. I've often found that it is harder to stand up to your friends than to your enemies, because the desire to be loved and approved by those that you care about is very intense. And having the courage to disagree when it's necessary to disagree is a very hard and painful thing to do. And it can, in some cases, be just as painful and difficult in its own unique way as bodily risk.
Well, Sarah, that's what you and I demonstrate on this podcast now for 6 years, right? the courage to disagree with someone you care about immensely.
Well, I don't think we have very enormous disagreements. I mean, you're wrong about the Eucharistic prayer, but other than that, I mean, we pretty much see eye to eye.
You're wrong about Paul Tillich.
Well, I don't think that fundamentally puts our relationship at risk, though. But I think what we're one of the reasons we're talking about this is because we know very well within and between churches, congregations, denominations, as well as across families, as well as across political parties, Americans especially, though others elsewhere too, are really struggling with how do I speak as truthfully as I can and as courageously as I can in the face of things that are genuinely fearful, from, you know, horrifying political developments to my own loved ones thinking that I'm a nutcase or a spawn of the devil or something like that. That is where the fear begins to take over for so many of us now. So right. that's where I think yours and my little disagreements are nothing compared to that.
Okay. Point taken. Let's move on. We actually have some backing in what we're saying from the classical tradition. The famous analysis of this is Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics. And he begins with that instinctual reaction of fear to perceived danger. And Aristotle's method in ethical analysis is to look for the golden mean. So he analyzed two opposite ethical responses to fear at perceived danger. On the one side was the vice of recklessness, and on the other side was the vice of cowardice. In between was the virtue of courage, which does not deny the danger but faces it bravely to meet it in a rational fashion. As you mentioned earlier, Sarah, Aristotle would agree flight or fight can be a rational response of courage to danger. Sometimes it takes courage to run away from a fight, right?
True.
Yeah. But recklessness or bravado in the face of danger is vicious, as is a kind of cowardly collapse in the face of danger, a kind of pitiful getting on your knees and begging, oh, please, 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 you know, don't do me wrong, rather than bravely standing up to the threat and saying, you are wrong, and putting your life on the line in the face of the danger to say your threats are immoral, like the martyrs do, right? Think of our podcast on Perpetua and Felicitas, right? And how they, with the power of the Holy Spirit and the courageous faith of the martyrs, she stared down the whole Colosseum. Right? That's her gaze defeated their gaze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it's been always much easier to see cowardice as a vice than recklessness or bravado as a vice. But I think now the internet has pointed up to an extreme degree the vice of recklessness or bravado in the form of what's often called internet trolls, trolling. But I think even more than ever in cancellation mobs, because there is absolutely no courage. There is nothing on the line to jump on an anonymous social media platform with 30,000 other anonymous strangers to destroy the reputation of one person. And often in those cases, though not always, the person who's attacked, of course, you know, we have no, again, human or evolutionary or cultural background for what it feels like to deal with 30,000 people together saying that you're evil and wrong, which usually results, often results in a response of cowardice, of backing down instead of having the courage of convictions. But I think more than ever, we see a lot of stuff that touts itself as courage is in fact the most toxic self-deceiving form of bravado, recklessness you could possibly hope for.
Yeah, it's a digital lynch mob is what it is.
But even less risky.
Even less risky. I just want to make the theological correlation. In relationship to God, recklessness is tempting God, putting God to the test.
Oh, nice.
By despising righteous judgment. And cowardice is to prefer other lesser dangers than the righteous judgment of God. So that's how I would parse that out.
Oh, that's very nice. Yeah, of course God will forgive me. That's his job, right? That's the reckless, it's really reckless contempt for God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so what's interesting to me, though, and this is one of the topics you wanted to raise, which maybe we can move into now, which is that we see this extreme form of the vices of cowardice and recklessness online. But behind it, there's a kind of legitimizing medicalization of ways of talking about fear that I think give a kind of veneer of legitimacy to accusations leveled against people. And that is, as you've observed, this kind of metastasis of phobias. So far as I know, it's Freud who coins the term from the Greek phobia. That's where the fear words come from. I think it got most famous in English from the 80s or 90s movie Arachnophobia, fear of spiders, which actually seems like a little bit more on the rational side. But since then, all sorts of phobias have been identified, classified, and diagnosed in people, whether or not they have been seeking help or consent to that diagnosis. So, Dad, why don't you riff on this for a while? What were you thinking in this regard?
I do respect modern medical psychology and its kind of clinical discussion of phobias, which they are all subsets of a basic anxiety disorder. And anxiety disorder is defined as a psychological state of persistent apprehension, just an unfocused fearfulness. And it's generally not specifically justified, but it's a kind of fear of life in general. And it takes on specific forms of persistent, and basically, this is the key point, irrational dread, which can then fixate on particular objects or circumstances, and to the extent that these phobias interfere with functioning in daily life. And the symptoms of this are like fainting and panic attacks. And there's actually, you can easily discover this in research. Psychologists classify a whole series of phobias in various way. Specific phobias, like, for example, of spiders and snakes. Now, I'm not so afraid of spiders, but living in Southwest Virginia, I'm damned afraid of snakes. I've had my encounters with copperheads and rattlesnakes, and even the benevolent black snakes who scare away the venomous snakes. When I see them unexpectedly, I jump. Right? I have a phobia of snakes.
Well, no, actually, I think it's really important to say you don't have a phobia of snakes, because a rational fear of snakes or an instinctive fear of snakes is very, very ancient in all primates, because primates like us and chimps and gorillas co-evolved with very deadly snakes. So there is a reason why you react to a snake before you can tell yourself, oh, it's just a black snake, it's harmless. I think a phobia of snakes would be that it so paralyzes you that you stop leaving your home in the country in Southwest Virginia because you might just meet a snake walking across your lawn. That would be the phobic state, right?
Well, or thinking they're under my bed or inside my pillow or something like that. Yeah. Okay.
But I think that I really want to stress this, because from a medical psychiatric diagnostic position, it has to be something that has gotten so out of hand that it controls and negatively affects your life. Again, fear is not a bad reaction to things that are genuinely dangerous.
Great. Good clarification, Sarah. So such phobias are medically recognized pathologies. And all we can say about this is seek medical treatment if you are experiencing such a dysfunctional and irrational fear of something, right?
Right.
Now, what I find curious in our contemporary culture, as already indicated, is the extension of this clinical diagnosis of phobia to a broad range of cultural phenomena. And I'll just tick these off: xenophobia, hatred of strangers; homophobia, hatred of homosexuals; Islamophobia, hatred of Muslims; transphobia, hatred of transgender people; even I've seen Christophobia, hatred of Christianity or of Christ. Now, what's going on with that, Sarah?
Well, what strikes me is that when you went through and defined all of those, you didn't say fear of, you said hatred of.
Exactly. There's a subtle shift going on here. We're going from clinically talking about an irrational fear to a specified ethically questionable hatred in greater or lesser degree. And that, I suppose, can range from dislike or disapproval to a kind of aggressive hostility which could precipitate violence. And this shift from irrational fear to ethically dubious group hatred is probably, I'm suggesting this as a hypothesis, is entailed by the extension of a psychological clinical diagnosis of irrational fear to describe various and, in my view, empirically heterogeneous social stigmatizations. So this subtle shift seems to me to be a function of a transfer from scientific medicine to, and here's the word that we talked about a lot last year, a transfer from scientific medicine to biopolitical service. Biopolitics, yes. It's our contemporary phenomenon of the medicalization of politics, which can plead the authority of science while actually leaving scientific procedure behind to deploy a logical fallacy of overgeneralization. That's my hypothesis, Sarah. What do you think?
All right, so let me paraphrase. So what you're suggesting, hypothesizing, is that politically interested faction can say, we do not like this ethical, cultural, personal, moral, social stance of X group within our nation. And so in order to suppress it or to delegitimize it, no matter what it may be, like you said, it's a heterogeneous range of things that people disapprove of, dislike, or whatever, instead of discussing it directly, going through normal democratic channels of conversation, debate, policy evaluation, and so forth. Instead, we just make the power move of labeling it as a phobia. It's some sort of psychiatric disorder in this group who holds an unpopular or undesirable opinion. And so we can just say that they're sick, so we can both bring them under the control of the of the medicalizing state and not engage with them seriously as citizens or voters or thinkers and dismiss them out of hand. That's kind of what you're going for?
Yeah, exactly. And that's recalling what we talked about a lot last year, biopolitics. Medical doctors become governors and politicians pretend to be therapists.
Right.
A confusion of roles, you know, that buffaloes a fearful public into conceding political power to alleged experts who in fact weaponize expertise. That's kind of the gist of biopolitics.
So an example of this would be is instead of acknowledging that there is a range of policy positions on immigration, both legal immigration, it's, you know, where from, the, you know, numbers allowable, all the way to how to deal with those who cross illegally and so forth. Instead of acknowledging that there are a range of opinions as well as a range of experiences, instead, anybody who questions the unalloyed good of unrestricted immigration is simply labeled a xenophobe. So you don't actually have to deal with the policy questions or the hard decisions. You can just say, well, they hate foreigners, so we don't have to take them seriously. That's their problem, their psychiatric problem. There's nothing of real political or policy substance here.
Right. I think that's exactly right. Right. And I think this analysis, Sarah, creates for Christian people, for Christian conscience, a real problem, because as we who believe in the healing of the great physician, and we would want normally to extend that to all God's suffering creatures. I mean, that seems to me to be a no-brainer. With the example of Jesus's healing, why shouldn't we want in every way possible to extend healing to suffering creation? But what is the difficult political and ethical question that is begged here is what constitutes normative health and healing? You know, that question is begged. It's simply when you can say, oh, you have a phobia, you're just racked with irrational hatred of X, Y, and Z group, then you can't get into the really tough question of what ethically are we to say about this behavior, and how are we politically to deal with it?
Right. And so behind these illegitimate diagnoses of non-scientifically verified phobias, there is a normative idea of health that is being put through, but not honestly or openly. It's covertly put through by diagnosing somebody with a, let's call it a fake phobia.
Right. So instead of asking for scientific evidence of a real, literal fear, irrational and unjustified, for example, to use the list of homosexuals, transgender people, Muslims, or Christians, the objection would be quite beside the political point. The political point is to shame those accused of being maladjusted, possessed by a phobia, driven by a repressed sexual desire or something like that. So in this deployment of phobia, evidence doesn't matter at all. What matters is silencing counter evidence and testimony. It's so, it seems to me, politically.
Oh, that's really good. I mean, it's really insightful the way you say it there. And of course, this raises also the specter of a very confused, emergent post-Christendom civilization that still, as you said, somehow claims or believes on some level in the great physician who makes all people well. But the church is not the state, and the state is not the church. And for the state to, or the establishment of whatever kind, whether it has the literal political power behind it or not, it could be the medical establishment as well, to co-opt the role of the great physician, therefore forces everybody to be a member of that physician's church, and therefore do obedience to that church, you can hear the scare quotes around that word church there. And so it becomes a form actually of dishonest religious power in a way to force conformity to this assumed good of the great physician and its church, which is not actually Christ at all.
No, of course. And that, well said, Sarah. Well said. In a post-Christian culture where we're still living ethically on the borrowed legacy of the past, these kinds of social goods are regularly retained on a purely secular ethical level, but without the dogma that backs them.
Yeah, and in fact, if I can extend the analogy even further, one of the hard-won lessons of Christendom is that you cannot force people to convert. They have to come to the faith freely. And it seems to me in this secularized appropriation of the great physician and his healing, we are actually demanding universal conversion of everybody to this idea of what is non-phobic, healthy, whole, normative existence. And in fact, we will not tolerate any heretics, or at least that is kind of the implicit trend of this kind of diagnosing of fake phobias, is that we must have everybody convert. And if they will not come freely, then be like Augustine and say, gather them up by force, force them to receive the grace of the great physician that is the state/establishment.
It's for their own good, right?
Yeah, it's for their own exactly. good, right. Boy, and that was the argument of the lockdown. Right.
Drive the people to happiness with an iron fist, Stalin.
Yeah, or with a hypodermic needle.
Now, let me just make an important qualification, clarification here. What we're saying about biopolitics hardly denies the sinful reality of group hatreds. We're not denying that at all. Only the pseudo-diagnosis of this reality of sinful group hatred as phobia. Now, let me illustrate. For example, Jew hatred is a recurring phenomenon throughout Western history and beyond. Denying this is denying manifest historical fact. But have you ever heard of Jew phobia?
Never. Not once.
We could, given the currency of still circulating conspiracy theories like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a fraud produced by the Tsarist government in Russia over 100 years ago. But Jew phobia would not fit among proponents, for example, of a pervasive Islamophobia, where at best the antiseptic antisemitism is preferred to the rather brutal truth which we've seen manifested in these recent days of Jew hatred.
That's so interesting, because of course what we've already observed is that the transference of the word phobic to not mean fear but hatred. And if that's the case, indeed, Judophobia is like the oldest phobia of that type in Western civilization. It runs thousands of years deep. Like it's like the or phobia or the or group hatred. And so the fact that it just strikes me for the first time that we don't have a word at hand for that, and yet Islamophobia so easily rolls off the lips. But that in itself is an enormous exposure of the fraud of these false diagnoses of fake phobias.
I think on analysis, the only point is to shame into some kind of social quarantine as misfits and cowards deep down, those who feel or express such politically incorrect enmities. If that's what you're doing with the terminology of phobia, I just say the people who use this kind of device to silence their political dissidents, watch out for the return of the repressed.
Well, yes, the idea that these strategies could actually work is shockingly naive and ignorant of history. But then again, if you knew anything about history, you wouldn't be taking these tactics in the first place.
As we speak today, This is the first vote in the New Hampshire primary for the Republican nomination. And I'm dreading, I don't mind confessing, that I'm dreading the return of the repressed in a vote for Donald J. Trump. Now, let's continue. Here's a thought experiment. In the recent past, the psychological coinage, Trump disorder syndrome, was deployed in similar fashion to the use of phobia to stigmatize obsessive and hysterical reaction to the vulgar former president.
Okay, let me just ask. So Trump disorder syndrome refers to people who react negatively to Trump, not to people who are sucked in and loyal to Trump.
Exactly. Hysterical overreactions to Trump.
Okay. I've heard it called Trump derangement syndrome. So yeah, that's either way, right?
Now, as a result, could we speak then of Trumpophobia? If not, why not? I mean, that's our job as theologians, is to ask a rational question and demand a rational answer. And I think the answer to the question of why not speak of Trumpophobia is because, at least I'm willing to argue, there is a real ascertainable political danger in that man's behavior. And why shouldn't that behavior be the focus of fair-minded and rational critique? And wouldn't, in its place, the accusation of a disorder or a phobia in critics of Trump simply be a way of evading the evidence and blunting the force of its analysis? So again, my warning, having learned the game of medicalizing political opposition, beware, anyone can play it. And God forbid, if Trump is elected the next president of the United States, he will play it with a vengeance.
Right, right. Well, he's already announcing that it will be a 4 years of revenge. So I think this gets back to the starting point we made, which is there is a difference between rational fear and irrational fear. And I think what you're trying to say is there are rational grounds for fear of the outcome of a second Trump presidency. There are also a lot of people who have what seems to be a deranged, irrational level of fear and reaction to Trump, from the beginning till now. And that what can happen is that if those are not actually distinguished, and if public discourse is not committed to the distinction, then in the end, all we're going to have is the scrabbling of accusations of fake psychiatric diagnoses, as you said, calling everything a phobia just to shut down your opponents. But you don't actually get anywhere. You don't actually get to the real issues, the real conversation that needs to be had. And that has become quite expedient in public discourse. Again, see everything about the internet.
Amen, sister. That's right on. That's exactly right. That's exactly the problem, is that Trump and his Trumpophobic critics need each other in a kind of a sixth symbiosis. Now, let's pose the question, what is the alternative?
And let me just say, before you go on to that, is yes, the sixth symbiosis is another way of saying polarization. The idea is that there are two poles and there have to be two of them in a feedback loop with each other to continue to make them more extreme and more distant from each other. And I think what we're trying to aim towards is we know that probably 90% of the American public hates, detests, disrespects, is turned off by this polarization and doesn't know how to find its voice, that does not get sucked into the vortex of either pole. And so this is where genuine courage in the face of truly fearful things, not fakely fearful or phobic reactions, is where we all need to come to our sticking point virtues of courage.
Okay, good. Now let's dig down past the superficial politics of our time and ask what would be the alternative to this sick symbiosis. And I would submit this. Perhaps there are good reasons in historical experience behind social hatreds, which must be excavated in order to be exorcised. And perhaps the real remedy of such obsessive fear is the courage of faith giving birth to love of the enemy. That has nothing to do with denying the reality of enmity or the reality of the hatreds.
Or the danger.
But let me illustrate what I mean. Politically volatile facts of history may be behind many of these so-called social phobias. Listen, I personally confess to a fear of a descent into a bottomless pit of recrimination. Hatfields and McCoys, forever and forever. Is that a real danger, or have I developed a phobia? Now, more seriously, are the Inquisition, the witch trials, and the Crusades the source of Christophobia? Yes, I think they are. Is the brave and faithful refusal of the Jewish congregation to assimilate into Christendom or antecedent empires the source of Jew hatred? Tragically, I think so. They were an unassimilable block within a cultural domination.
Those are two really interesting examples to put in apposition, because the first one, the Inquisition, Witch Trials, Crusades, that is a legitimately bad, awful, evil behavior on the part of Christians, giving rise to hatred of Christians and Christianity, though I think a lot of it is deployed tactically now in a way to amplify fear that is not genuine. But the second example you give is of a legitimate option on the part of a religious community not to assimilate, with a similar result of hatred. So I think that's one of the points you're trying to make here, is that there are historical sources for strong reactions, and some of them might be justified, like, yes, we're not going to love the Crusaders who come rape, pillage, and plunder your land. And there are some that are illegitimate, like, no, you actually do have to respect the conscience of your Jewish neighbors who are not interested in becoming Christians. So the different historical sources can lead to legitimate and illegitimate reactions of fear or hatred.
That's why some time ago I described these as heterogeneous. You know, that they're not all the same, but they can generate equivalent social prejudices, right? That's what I'm getting at. And that we have to actually get down into the weeds of historical excavation to get behind. Here's another example. The so-called xenophobia. Isn't that actually a fear of the threat of cultural exappropriation or even colonization? Now, I'm thinking about all the American working class, the white American working class, that is so pissed off about the flood of illegal immigration into the United States. And, you know, what they're angry about and what they're fearing is some kind of, you know, this is called, you know, kind of in an exaggerated way, replacement theory, that it's all a conspiracy to displace the white people with people of color. I think that's a lot of nonsense. But in fact, you know, what we're seeing right now is that in the urban centers of the United States, a lot of minorities, African Americans and Hispanics, are angry because they've been on the short end of the stick in this country for decades, and they feel like they are being shortchanged with the Biden administration's policy favoring this massive influx of illegal immigrants to their detriment. Now, is that xenophobia, or is that an actual historical complaint?
There's a range of answers, right? I'm sure there are some people who just don't like people who look and talk and act like them. Sure. Yeah, that exists. That's also a very deep human thing. And then there are others who have legitimate grievances that justice is not being served or is being, doled out to some group at the expense of others. And it might be matching up with their nation of origin or race or whatever. So there's a legitimate grievance there. So like you said, each case in a way is its own case. And so to just tag it as a generalized medical condition fails to acknowledge the specifics of the person as well as the specifics of the history behind it.
Yeah, and I think we can make the same analysis of so-called transphobia. I personally don't have any difficulty with an argument that mature adults can genuinely come to the conclusion of gender dysphoria afflicting them and want medical help to transition their genders in a way that suits what's going on in their self-understanding. But the idea that you can make this diagnosis to minor children who have no concept of what changes are being proposed to their natural hormonal development, and then even further with dramatic surgical interventions, I find this, and that without parental advice and consent in some cases, that strikes me as simply outrageous. And I think the flashpoint has come with permission of biological males into female sports. Now, is that the real source of so-called transphobia? I mean, to me, these are very open questions.
Yeah, I think I take a different view of this, and I think it's because I am a female, an actual real female, and not a male. I actually think trans ideology and practice is evil. I just think it's an unrestricted evil. And any adult who has come to have gender dysphoria is already the victim of so much harm socially, culturally, interpersonally, that it's only a last resort of survival. But I'll tell you something about fear. I don't think I've told you this story, Dad, but recently I was traveling and I needed to use the bathroom, and the bathroom was in a courtyard out of the way, not with anybody around to see it. And there was one door that led one way down a hall and around a corner to the women's room, and then the men's room was in another part of the courtyard. I went down that hall, I went to open the door of the ladies' room, and a man came out. It was a man in the ladies' room, and there was no way you could possibly mistake that it was the men's room or an all-purpose bathroom. And I even as I talk about this, I am flooded with adrenaline remembering it, because I'll tell you, Dad, one way you know that you are a biological female is the amount of fear you feel when you are in a strange place with a strange man and you don't know what he's capable of. And so the man said, "Oh, come on in," which would have forced me to walk past him. And I said, "No, I'll wait till you're out." And he said, "Oh, but there's plenty of room." And I said, "I will wait till you're out." And I just stared him down with the most harsh and uninviting glare I possibly could. And so he just walked past me and walked on. I have no idea what was going on there, if now just males generally think they have a right to female spaces because trans has legitimized that, or if this guy, you know, said, "Well, I am a female on the inside, even if I don't dress like one." There's a small possibility he was a complete idiot and could not see the women's sign very plainly on the front door. But to me, what trans is the current instantiation of misogyny, and it's forcing biological females to be afraid in public. And to me, one of the great victories of a liberal civilization is that women can move in most places in public in freedom. Not everywhere. I don't think it's possible to have a civilization where women are always safe at all times. The cost to everyone's freedom for that to be possible just couldn't happen. And in fact, it would just be used again to target women. But I'll tell you that this is not a hatred of trans people, but it is a fear of men who milk the system to get access to women-only spaces. And I saw further evidence of this. I was And a place in the States at a public library. That was one of the first places I ever saw that declared that its bathrooms were all gender bathrooms. And they were stalls. It wasn't just private. And I was horrified. And I was like, I'm never going in the bathroom there again, because I don't know who's going to be in there. When I came back recently and saw this place again, they are now locked doors. You have to go to the desk and get a key. And it's only one person at a time. And you know why that is? Because women are not safe when men can have access to women's only spaces. So, sorry, I didn't mean to go on a big testimony about trans there, but I think it actually demonstrates very well that there are real fears and real dangers, and decisions we make have genuine effect. And I defy anyone to tell me I'm transphobic. I am not afraid of trans people. I am afraid as a woman of being attacked in a place where I should be safe.
Yeah, excellent, Sarah. Good for you. And that's actually the courage of Perpetua staring down the guy and forcing him to move out. Yeah. Look at, I think the point here, though, is that to sweep all this under a basket of phobia excludes the kind of testimony and problem that you're talking about. And that right. What we really need is to create a gracious space in which these kinds of genuine the genesis of genuine social phobias can actually be talked about. I mean, the genesis of actual prejudices can be talked about rather than swept under the rug as some kind of psychological malady, something like that. Let me just finally mention Islamophobia, because I think there's a lot here that's very thick. It's a very thick and difficult set of problems. And this summer, I'm going to teach a seminar on Islam as a problem of Christian theology. I've been working on this issue for many years, since 9/11. But I would just like to say that it's not simply a racist bigotry against people of Muslim background, but after 9/11, the memory of Islamic conquest and colonization of previously Christian populations might be in the background here of this renewal of so-called Islamophobia. And I think that rather than a kind of a cheery interfaith, we're all together in this kind of very superficial kind of thing, history shows, and this was the politically unpopular point of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. This came out actually before 9/11, but it predicted 9/11. And the refueling of an ideology like we see in Hamas has historical roots. And you can't sweep this problem under the rug by calling it a phobia. There's a real question here and a real problem. Yes, if we're willing to criticize the Christian crusaderism in the medieval period, we have to first be also willing to analyze and critique Islamic conquest and colonization of previously Christian populations.
Yeah, I think there you see here, too, the toxic and unthinking polarization. I noticed that just as sort of Western Islamophobia, oh, I'm just using the phrase there, rose, there was also kind of a counterpoint of refusal to say anything ever had been wrong with Islam or Islamic activity. So like it became sort of a left-wing piety to say, oh, Islam is purely a religion of love and it's ethical and it's good. And then also to say like, well, the West did such terrible things to Muslims that basically anything they do back to us or to, of course, the Jews is justified. So it's like, so they're just like mirror images of each other, these extreme things. And without understanding the whole range of complexities, the whole range of religious claims, the whole sequences of conquests, and also both individuals and societies' decisions about whether they're going to fan the flames of hatred or not. I mean, clearly Hamas is deeply invested in fanning the flame of Jew hatred, plain and simple, right? Not all Muslims are like that, but some Muslims are like that, you know, and not all Christians hate Muslims, but some Christians do. So we have to deal with the horrifyingly complex reality rather than, as you said, just give it a fake psychiatric label in order to shut down discussion.
Now, I will say there, I think there, you might disagree with me, but I think there's one exception to that, what we're just saying. It seems to me that homophobia is something real. I think there is a kind of revulsion at same-sex attraction among straights and perhaps even more among closeted homosexuals. You and I both know an individual who was a champion of family values and fathered a number of children, 5 or 6, before he finally dealt with his homosexuality and came out of the closet. And he has spent all those years actively resisting the recognition that his attraction to the same sex was just part of who he was. Now, it seems to me then there actually is a phobia here. It's not just in heterosexuals, but it's also in closeted homosexuals. And I think this is a matter that's subject to psychological therapy. What do you think of that?
Well, maybe there's, again, a generational difference here. I have only ever heard that any objection whatsoever to homosexual desire, acts, whatever, the only possible explanation for it can be revulsion, fear, and that you're probably gay and not admitting it to yourself. So to me, I think that that is a real phenomenon, what you described. I don't think it's anywhere near adequate to describe the whole range of possible ethical and moral responses to homosexuality. And it can be used again, it can be weaponized again too. But I think what you said is a real thing. But I also think that itself can be weaponized to shut down actual ethical conversation.
Yeah, you know, you talked about your experience. Let me just mention mine here quickly. In my first couple of weeks at Bard College as an 18-year-old freshman, I got friendly with a guy and I thought he was an interesting, smart guy. And all of a sudden he was propositioning me and I was like really freaked out. What's going on here? You know? And then years later, I was a teaching assistant at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and I had lots of gay men who were my students. And this was when the AIDS crisis was at its climax, and these guys were dying right in front of my eyes. And it was just a horrible thing to live through, you know. And so I had kind of this both professional teaching and also personal pastoral relationship with a number of gay men in New York City in the early 1980s, which kind of formed my conscience about these things. Now, even then, when I had built up enough trust, I could gently criticize homophile behaviors. I mean, you know, when you go out in this wild promiscuity that gay men were practicing in the early 1980s in New York City, and then you are angry at God because you've gotten AIDS. I mean, you know, come on. If I smoke 3 packs of cigarettes for 30 years and get lung cancer, am I to be angry at God? I mean, there's just basic science here that mature people deal with, right? So I think that the homophobia being weaponized to stigmatize any kind of critique of homophile behavior shades into the analysis we've been making of biopolitics, the medicalization of politics.
Right. And I think maybe just to conclude is, we're back to this, I feel like, where American society is there has to be one code of ethics that everybody is legally obligated to obey. And so the very idea that there are multiple and non-commensurate views of what is right and good, I mean, to me, the whole American experiment was, can people who genuinely disagree still live together? That is the positive right. good of American democracy. And in a really fascinating book by a woman named Dara Horn called People Love Dead Jews, she says she says one reason for longstanding Jew hatred is the Jew represents the eternal possibility of nonconformity, refusal to be assimilated. And yes. I think by extension, maybe one of the reasons why Jew hatred has sprung up again so strongly is because so many people now feel it is intolerable to have people who ethically disagree with me living within my borders. And if we can't do that, then of course there will be bloodshed and there will be a contest of survivals. The ability to allow, I really, really, really think differently than you about this, and somehow we have to live together in the same space, I would deeply regret if that meant more locked doors, but maybe that's necessary. I'd prefer not. But, you know, I think we have to hold out that ethical disagreement within structured ways of coexistence is the positive good that allows us all to obey conscience and be courageous as needed to stand by our own convictions.
Absolutely. And the excavation of the historical grounds for various kinds of social prejudgments or prejudices or even bigotries is exactly how you actively practice tolerance. Tolerance doesn't mean I agree or I like what you're doing, but it does mean I take you seriously as a human being with your own historically grounded set of grievances, and I want to engage with you and talk about how you got to where you are, just as like I will make myself open and vulnerable to you in talking to you about how I am at the position where I'm at, right? So I think just get the whole biopolitical move to stigmatize as phobia your selected sources, your selected political opponents. Recognize that that's nothing more than a power play. It's not any kind of serious theology of politics or reconciliation.
Yeah, I agree very strongly. And I think the Christian disposition in the world needs to be seeking reconciliation where reconciliation is possible and resisting when resisting is necessary. I think there's again, polarized versions that are reconciliation only, which give everything away, or resistance only, which circle the wagons and, you know, build up the walls. And, you know, it's all, I just said to someone recently, discernment is everything and discernment is hard. So there's not simplistic rules here. They do have to be discerned and discernment is hard. But I mean, that is actually what we have to do. Discern where to seek reconciliation and where to stand tall, stand fast and resist.
Yeah. And that takes the wisdom of a power higher than you and I to make that distinction. But I think finishing this up, I think the flashing red light here, or yellow light, the flashing danger signal, is to remember the Soviet practice of institutionalizing as mentally ill dissidents. And if we don't check this development that we've described in the biopolitical medicalization of social dissent as some kind of phobia, right? If we don't stop that, we're on the trajectory of ending up with Soviet-style institutionalizing of political opponents as mentally ill.
Right. Yeah. Yes, that is a very salutary warning.
Now, look, let's come back to Christian theology.
All right.
The Christian theology of fear with which we began is summarized simply in the claim that the one who fears the Lord and his judgment of righteousness is delivered from any other fear on the earth. Though devils all the world should fill, all eager to devour us. We tremble not, unmoved we stand. They cannot overpower us. Take they goods, fame, fortune, child, and spouse. They yet have nothing won. The kingdom ours remaineth. How's that for fightin' words?
Them sounds like good fightin' words.
The judgment of righteousness for Christians is that Christ died for our sins and was raised for our justification. Therefore, fear not. Face the dangers courageously and don't succumb to abject, cowardly fear or reckless bravado. And the political moral of the story is the hard work of genuine toleration and reconciliation begins with the excavation of history that has formed our fears and hardened them into injurious prejudgments. So we do this excavation to achieve genuine self-knowledge. Where did my biases, my prejudices, my fears come from? And analyzing and criticizing that, coming to appropriate repentance. And we do this together with our perceived enemies in order to step towards the beloved community of God. And here I would lift up again the Jewish philosopher Peter Oakes's scriptural reparative reasoning program as a concrete practice that moves in that direction.
Okay, very good. Well, for something that started out in our minds so disorganized, I think we really made some progress here and got a good handle on what we're facing and how to address it.
Thank you, Sarah, and we'll look forward to future bathroom stories from you.
I hope that's the one and only, honestly. Lutheran though I may be, I prefer not to talk about times in the bathroom. Okay, well, next time on the show, legalism and antinomianism.
Thanks for listening to the Queen of the Sciences podcast. For show notes and more, visit our website, queenofthesciences.com. To find out more about what we do, visit sarahhenlickewilson.com and paulhenlicke.com. Finally, please leave us a review on iTunes and tell a friend about the show.